The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
This evening, we have the privilege of hearing a prophet. Webster defines a prophet as someone who can predict future events. And Dr. Schiller, in his book Irrational Exuberance, gave a forecast with regard to the potential collapse of the dot-com bomb, which took place in the 2000-2001 period. And then in his second edition, he added new information about real estate and the housing bubble, which became the second bubble that he forecast correctly would collapse. You have an excellent biographical information about Dr. Schiller in your program, which I encourage you to read, but I thought you might be interested in a couple of items that are not in that program note. One is the fact that Dr. Schiller lived in Philadelphia, 6th and Spruce, he tells me, from 1975 to 1980 when he taught at the University of Pennsylvania. The second is that his focus is particularly around behavioral economics, and he teaches a course for graduate students at Yale on behavioral and institutional economics and a linkage between the impact of people's behavior and the institutions which we create and their impact on our behavior. And the third item that I thought you might be interested in is that next semester he'll be on sabbatical, and he's already working on his next book, which is entitled Animal Spirits, which is, I think you can imagine, will probably deal with some of the behavior, not the least of which are greed and fear that motivate our behavior from an economic point of view. So with that background, I hope that you'll join me in an enthusiastic welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia to Dr. Robert Schiller.
Thank you for that nice introduction. Well, it's nice to be back in Philadelphia, having lived here years ago. I should have also added my son is now a student at University of Pennsylvania, so I feel happy to be here. So I wanted to talk about, as you know, about the subprime crisis. There'll be two parts to my talk. First part is how did we get in this mess? Second part is what should we do about it? I believe that the most important thing that economists do is not forecast the future, but it's to talk about institutional changes that can help prevent these problems from ever happening. So that's the most important part of what I want to talk about. I want to begin, though, by giving my analysis of the crisis. And as Morris was saying, and maybe it has something to do with my interest in behavioral economics. There's a revolution going on now in the economics profession and in the finance, academic finance profession, under the word behavioral. What is happening is that people in these fields are discovering that we really should have listened to the psychologists and the sociologists after all. The economics is viewed by many people as the queen of the social science. At least economists say that, because it's highly mathematical and technical and impressive. It looks like theoretical physics at times. But now we're discovering that we really have to listen to insights from other social sciences. And that's my theme here, that I think the subprime crisis was caused by our psychology and our thinking, our herd behavior, our interactions with each other. It's unfortunate we can't rely just on the economics department to understand it. Notably, the crisis is really caused by bubbles. The term bubble goes way back, hundreds of years. And it's a theory that is so simple and obvious that most economists consider it disreputable. It didn't come from us. It came from common observers. But I think that often we have to look at some of the simpler explanations. And so what a bubble is, I'll give it a brief definition. It occurs when some speculative price is going up rapidly, and it gets people excited. They hear stories. Some guy bought and sold, and he made a lot of money last year. In fact, just buying a house or something like that, the person made more money on that transaction than I did working for a whole year. And I feel terrible. Like, what kind of a fool and sucker am I? And so I'm faced with a quandary. Should I get into this? Should I come into this investment as well? And you hold off for a while, and you hold off for a while. But then as years go by, and the market still keeps going up, and more of your friends are just raking in the money, and finally you give up, and you try it too. You say, I've held out long enough, and all those guys who said it was a bubble, it still hasn't burst yet. Of course, that's when it bursts. And so that's the story of a bubble. But I think that what's been happening in the U.S. and in the world as well has been a sequence of bubbles, and that we've been in a volatile time in our speculative markets, and that ultimately what is driving the current problem. So I wanted to start by showing you bubble pictures. The first one here is a chart that I created for my Irrational Exuberance book, and it's updated now. This shows the red line is the one to look at, the top line. That shows home prices in the United States from 1890 to 2008, okay, in real terms. And it's for, as best as we can do it, a constant house. Okay, houses have gotten bigger and better, so we're correcting for that. And it suggests what an investment would have been. So, I don't know if you probably can't hear me if I walk over here. You can't. This is 1890, all right? So it would have been a great idea to buy a house in 1890 and hold it for 100 years, right? Where would you be? You'd be right here. Do you know what your return would be? It'd be like something like 0.2% per year. But look what happened here. What is this here? That's the current bubble. And it's very anomalous by historical perspective. There's only one other example, something like it, and that has a name. It's called the baby boom. After World War II, the soldiers came home, and they wanted to have families now, and they wanted a two-bedroom house. And President Roosevelt had shut down the construction industry, so they weren't there. So they bid the prices up. That's the only other bubble. It wasn't as big as the recent one. So something very strange is going on. And I don't see that it's justified by any of the fundamentals shown. I have building costs, I have population, and I have interest rates. Those are doing things, but they're not doing anything that seems dramatic. So I think that what has happened is that we've had a bubble. Oh, I can do, I can, oh, very good. Now I'm free. I wanted to show you, this is a plot. Is this working all right? Yeah. This is a plot of a number of cities. I don't have Philadelphia. Incidentally, that's because we're slow to... Philadelphia data reporting is slow, as I was just explaining. And so we don't... I have with Standard & Poor's. It's called the Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Home Price Indexes. But we don't do Philadelphia. We have to correct that. But you see what a number of other cities... These are home price indices in real terms... since 1987. And you can see it's different across cities, but something happened in common to all these cities starting in either the late 1990s or the early 2000s. They all went up quite dramatically, and they're all coming down. So one thing that happened, there's an old adage that real estate is local. Well, that may have been true, but it's less true today. We're getting a market that moves together. It goes also beyond the U.S., as I'll show in a minute. These are three-tiered home price index for low-priced homes, middle-priced homes, and high-priced homes. And this is, again, Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller data, but we have it here. I'm just showing San Francisco. What you notice is that the low-priced homes, prices went up the most, right? And came down the most afterwards. That has to do with the fact, I believe, with subprime lending. Subprime lending has expanded rapidly after 2000, and they are low-income borrowers, generally, who buy lower-priced homes. So you can see that we had a huge increase in home prices that was reversed. I said it was international. This shows London, England. It's really remarkable. Again, in real terms, correcting for inflation, London had this huge home price boom. The red line is London. It came all the way back down. It peaked around 1990, came all the way back down, and then it had an even bigger explosion in London. And now it's starting to go down, and there's a lot of pessimism over there. What's interesting is how similar it is to Boston across the Atlantic. This is an international event. So it can't be explained in terms of just what Alan Greenspan did. It's Mervyn King or somebody else. I think it goes beyond what central banks are doing. It's a social phenomenon. The problem also goes beyond the housing market. This is the stock market for the United States, all the way back to 1871. This is the Standard & Poor's Composite Stock Price Index. And you can see the incredible bubble we had in the 1990s. Isn't that unusual? I mean, doesn't that stand out? That's 2000, and then it collapsed. Then it rallied again, and then collapsed more. We're about where we were 10 years ago in the stock market. We've had a bad decade in stock market. But the thing that's interesting is how rare and unusual this is. How often do we have these events? Well, this one, remember this one? This is the roaring 20s, and we peaked in 29, and then we had the Great Depression. Quite a remarkable, but how often did we have them? You don't see them very much. In fact, there's only two. The 20s and the 90s that are really stand out. I just want to show some other countries. We're in a bubbly time in history, I think. Let's look at India. This is the Sensex index. Again, I corrected for Indian inflation. Kind of lumping around, not doing anything. And then bang, in 2003, it goes up fivefold. From 2003 to 2008. And look what it's doing now. It's suddenly dropping. But it's even better in China. This is the Shanghai Composite Index in China. And it wasn't, you know, even though in China had this phenomenal economic growth, their stock market was doing nothing until just a couple years ago, and then it went up fivefold. And it came down two-thirds of the way back down. This is almost the same as the 1920s example that we saw in the United States. So something has been happening around the world that I think is of historic importance. Let me get back to what I think bubbles are and what their causes are. I mentioned before that it was an event of social psychology, but it's a little bit of economics has to be in there as well. Bubbles occur when people see prices going up rapidly. I mentioned this before, and they see other people making a lot of money. And it really psychs some people to see that happen. But it's not just what I've just said. There's another component to bubbles. When you have a bubble, people talk, and the kind of stories and theories and ideas change too. During a bubble, it tends to facilitate conversation about positive, new era type stories. And stories that had been in the back of people's minds and forgotten are remembered again if they support the idea of a bubble. And so as this is proceeding, a whole different world view appears that justifies the bubble. So let's talk about the real estate bubble that we just had. And now I'm talking about this period right here. What happened, I believe, in that period is we changed our ideas about investing. And the idea suddenly became that housing is the best investment, and that home prices always go up. So the idea is, I've heard it recently attributed to Will Rogers, but I've not been able to track it down. He said, buy real estate. They ain't making no more land. The observation is, well, yeah, land is fixed, and population is growing, and the economy is growing, so home prices should always go up. Well, I find that that theory is talked about more, a lot more, when the market is booming than when it's not. I did a search of old newspapers. It's hard to find any reference to that story in this whole period. I actually found a reference to it right in here, right around here, the time of the boom. It tends to come up during booms. During times when home prices haven't been going up, people, they may think that, but then they say, well, doesn't sound right, forget about that. They don't talk about it. So we develop a view that's different. Another thing that's happened, there's been a long history of land speculation. It goes back hundreds or thousands of years. People would buy acreage in order to profit from price increases. But we have a new idea, 21st century idea. Forget land. Just buy a house anywhere. It doesn't matter where. Anywhere. If you took that theory back 50 years ago and tried to explain that to someone back then, they would be puzzled indeed by this statement. Buy any house? Are you kidding? Houses depreciate. They impose all kinds of costs on you. They go out of style. They tear them down eventually. And land is a small component of a house anyway. But our whole view has changed. And that's what happened in the bubble. And the problem is that the bubble pervaded our thinking. And it led to failures of various sorts, including regulatory failures. That is, the people who were regulating the subprime lenders or the banks, they believed in this too. I think that the people who were giving out mortgages to subprime borrowers, many of them were doing it, mortgages that these people would have trouble paying, they were doing it in good conscience. They thought that we're letting these people in on the same bonanza that's been making all of us rich. Why don't subprime people deserve to get rich off this boom as well? But you know, there's something funny going on when we all think we're getting rich, okay? But we're living in the same houses. And so what has changed? Well, we're all paying more for them. And so it wasn't real. And eventually it got a correction. The problem is that the correction is now causing changes that I think may be damaging to the economy and long-lasting. One thing that's happening is that people are being thrown out of the houses they bought. They are unable to pay the mortgage payments. This is part of the reason why prices are dropping. Fannie and Freddie have been accumulating a huge inventory of homes that they acquire through defaults and foreclosures. And now if they try to sell them, they're in trouble. They have to try to sell them, and that puts downward pressure on the market. We have a fundamental problem that I think has a risk of creating a slow economy for years to come. That it'll change our psyche, our way of viewing ourselves. And I don't mean to be forecasting any disaster, but I think it's something of great concern. And I think that it's important that the new Congress that's coming in, the 111th Congress that's coming early next year, and our new president start to think about how we got to this situation and what we should do next. So I have 15 more minutes, I believe. I wanted to outline a plan for the resolution of this crisis and for the prevention of new such crises. You might think that our presidential candidates would be laying out such a plan, but they are not, neither of them. And I think that that's not really surprising, because I don't think that an election campaign is the time or the proper venue for thinking about the kind of fundamental changes that are needed. I'm hopeful that whoever is elected next year will take this on as a serious crisis. In the 1930s, after the Hoover administration was succeeded by the Roosevelt administration, the president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, felt that he had the mandate for big changes. And he and his administration created the New Deal, and it involved a lot of institutional changes. They created the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Housing Administration, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. I could go on and on. And those institutions are with us today. So the crisis of the 1930s spawned a lot of changes that were permanent. And so I think that's what we should think about this time, that we should think about making changes. We haven't had such a big sequence of changes since the 30s. So I have a list of things in my book about that we should do. The first, I'm going to divide it up between short-term solutions and long-term solutions. And then after I go through my whole plan for the new economy, we'll open it up for questions or criticisms. In the short term, I think that we have to have show some sympathy for the people who are suffering the most. Having taken on a mortgage that was apparently recommended by the authorities, that regulators did not disapprove of, and now finding that I'm going to lose my house perhaps have to declare bankruptcy, that's a national tragedy. And the fact that it's going on such a scale it also runs the risk of changing our morale and our sense of togetherness in our nation, our sense of cooperation. So I think that we need bailouts. Fortunately, both of our presidential candidates agree. Both of them supported the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008, which arranged for a federal bailout of up to 400,000 homeowners. McCain wants to bail out more. He said so in his some of his pronouncements. But I think this is an important step, and we have to make sure that there is a sense of justice. I suppose Obama may also do the same thing if he becomes president. We recently saw the bailout of bondholders of Fannie and Freddie. These are the two big mortgage lenders that account for almost half of the mortgages. And there's a lot of concern that these bailouts are hitting the taxpayer and supporting investors, you might conclude that they were a bad thing. A lot of foreigners buy Fannie and Freddie bonds. So now if the U.S. government guarantees them, that means that the U.S. taxpayer has a risk of having to pay that. But I think we have to do that. Again, we have to maintain confidence and trust in our economic system. And since the Fannie and Freddie bonds were presented as if they might be government bonds, it was never clear. And because the government had its hands in the operations of Fannie and Freddie, and it had a regulatory agency, OFAO, which was approving what Fannie and Freddie were doing, it is plausibly a government bond. The U.S. has never defaulted on its government bonds, and we can't start doing it this time. And so I think the bailout plan for Fannie and Freddie was the right thing to do. Similarly, the bailout of Bear Stearns was the right thing to do, unfortunately, in the messy circumstance that we're in. However, bailouts after the fact are not the ideal way to proceed. And so this brings me now to what I think are the most important thing to do is to get to the right long-term solution. It represents a long trend in history that we are doing things more and more by standards, by modern finance and insurance methods. We now have Social Security, for example, and we have health insurance. These are programs that are managed according to financial principles to deal with risks. Those programs used to be handled by charity, right? There would be beggars, and there would be charitable organizations that gave help to the poor. We're in a modern time, and we wanted to try to do things using risk management principles and consistent, planned in advance principles. If you have to rely on charity, it's never going to work as well. So that means what I'm thinking is that for the long run, we want to develop a system that will systematically prevent this kind of crisis from happening. And I have a whole bunch of things. I'm just going to have to go through kind of quickly with them. I have three parts to this proposal. This is a whole plan for the U.S. the three parts are, first, to improve the financial information infrastructure. And the second part is to expand the scope of our financial markets. And the third part is to create new financial products, retail products that deal with the general public. So let me go through those in turn. I have a slide. I've got it here. Okay. This is about the information infrastructure. First of all, we have to encourage disinterested financial advice. And I think that means government subsidies of financial advice. This is an unusual idea. I don't know if you've heard this before. But little known fact is the government does subsidize financial advice. There's a tax deduction for financial. I know you're a financial advisor, so I met you at dinner. However, it's only for people who itemize. And so everybody else wouldn't get any deduction for financial advice. So I think we have to think further about the fact that most Americans are not getting financial advice. They get salespeople. They get a realtor who sells them a house. They get a mortgage broker that puts them into a mortgage. And these people are often or generally well-meaning, but their advice tends to be biased by their need to make a sale. What I would like to see happen is that people who will sign a statement that they will not take a commission, they are operating only as advisors, would be subsidized by the government. Secondly, we need a financial watchdog. This is an idea that we should have an agency of the government, an ombudsman that protects the consumer. This is actually a proposal that Elizabeth Warren at the Harvard Law School proposed. She calls it a Financial Products Safety Commission, modeled after the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Default option financial planning refers to having institutions that automatically default people into a sensible risk management position unless they specify otherwise. We saw this happen with the Pension Reform Act of 2006, which made it possible for companies to put people into 401k plans without their asking. They could ask to be removed, but the default is to be in there. We need to improve financial disclosure. Right now, we don't know much at all about what hedge funds are investing in. Even Ben Bernanke doesn't know what they're doing. So we have a risk of systemic effects that cannot even be assessed by anyone. The complicated system of mortgage securities that we have, it's hard to understand for many investors, and improved disclosure would help that. And I'll go quickly through. Improve financial databases. I think that the government collects a lot of data. They should try to make it available to be in a way that's financially active so that people can make use of these databases for risk management. And finally, I think we need a new system of economic units and measurement, which I won't describe here at this time. I want to get to the long-run solutions because I only have 5 more minutes in my time here. We have need for financial markets that allow us to trade the risks that are important to us. We have huge risk in our real estate markets and almost no ability to trade or hedge these risks. This is something it's been a campaign of mine for a number of years. In 2006, my colleagues and I worked with the Chicago Mercantile Exchange to create the world's first successful, or moderately successful, I wish it were more successful, futures markets for single-family homes. And we have now trading in Chicago at the Merc 10 U.S. cities. So that means investors can buy interest in U.S. homes, or they can short them. We've had a situation where no one could short. Even though you didn't believe in the bubble, you couldn't short it to bet against it. But we've changed that. If we have better markets, then institutions can start managing the risks. Fannie and Freddie, for example, were not managing their real estate risks. That's why they got into trouble. Home prices fell, and they became insolvent or close to insolvent. I think also we can have markets on other important risks like incomes and even GDP. I'm trying to advocate. I tried this in the U.S. I have a long history of trying to get ideas going, and I'm not discouraged easily. Right now, we are trying to get the Canadian government to issue claims on their GDP, and each claim would be called $1 trillion. It could be 1/1,000,000,000 of Canadian GDP. If we're successful, you should be investing. You might want to invest in trills, invest in our neighbor in Canada. But it would be a risk management device that would be fundamentally important. But let me go further to the new retail risk management institutions. And maybe of these three, the most important is the continuous workout mortgages. What is a workout? A workout is you can't pay on your mortgage. You go to the mortgage lender and you say, I'm out of luck, you know, what do you want me to do? I'll give you the keys, I'll leave, I can't pay it anymore. Mortgage lenders often allow you a workout. They will say, okay, they don't want you to leave because that costs them a lot. And unless it's if they can find something that you can pay, they'll actually lower your debt and lower your monthly payments. This is the system we have, and a lot of people are getting workouts, but most people still aren't. But the problem with this system is that it's all after the fact. It looks like charity. You go to the mortgage originator and you say, what will you do for me? It's all beyond the contract, and it depends on the goodwill of this other person. Moreover, it only happens after you've reached the breaking point. You've been trying to pay on your mortgage, and now you throw up your hands and you say, I can't do it. Why do we wait until it reaches the breaking point? Why don't we make adjustments continually? That's why I call it continuous workup. So what I think we should do in the future is have mortgage contracts that have terms built into them so that people who take out the mortgages see their payments automatically adjusted so that if times get bad or if home prices fall, their mortgage goes down. If we had had those, there would not be a subprime crisis today. People would not be being thrown out of their homes. It would be smoothly and continuously managed. So I think this is a very important, although it's a radical change from what we're doing. Now, some people will say, well, how is the mortgage originator going to afford this? Because why is a mortgage originator going to allow me to reduce my mortgage and do it so easily? That's because the mortgage originator would hedge the risk of these home price declines in markets that allow hedging of the risk. This is a whole scheme to develop our markets and hedge the risk and spread risk. I've been teaching finance to undergraduates, and I keep telling them the most important lesson of finance is diversify and spread your assets all over. And then I meet people, and they tell me, all I've got is this house, and it's in one city, and by the way, I've borrowed 90% of the money to get it. If that house just goes down 10%, I'm wiped out. And I'm thinking, this person is approaching retirement, and that's all they have? They haven't been giving them right advice. So I think we need continuous workout mortgage. They should be the default option for mortgages. We should have financial advisors who are telling people to do this rather than something else. And we should have hedging markets that allow this thing to work well. The other two ideas are home equity insurance. That's an extension of what we call homeowners insurance that would allow you to insure the value of your house, the market value of your house. Homeowners insurance is getting somewhat obsolete. It was created in the days when fires were common. But fires are much less common because we have better building codes and fire departments. And so we don't have to... But market value of home is getting awfully volatile. So why doesn't homeowners insurance cover that? And finally, livelihood insurance. That's an extension of what we call disability insurance now. We already insure people's livelihoods against an illness that would prevent them from earning an income. But why don't we protect them against something affecting the market value of their income as well, such as a recession or something that some changes in the oil market or some other market that makes people find it difficult to make a living. So you see the whole principle of what I'm getting at here. I might summarize it, and I'll turn to questions now, but I might summarize it by saying what I'm advocating here is contrary to what a lot of people are saying about the crisis. A lot of people think that we should punish our financial sector for having done terrible things to all of us. I think that, on the contrary, we need to develop our financial sector and develop it so that it works for the people. That's what they're all about anyway. They should all be about, and to work for everybody. So what I call this is the democratization of finance. That's what we need to do. Democratization in the sense that we want to develop our financial markets so that they serve everyone, low income as well as high income. And there's a number of steps that I've outlined that would do that. Now, I think that this kind of development would either reduce the prevalence of bubbles, or if not that, they would at least reduce the impact of bubbles on people. And if we had been better diversified, we would not have the subprime crisis today. And everything would be smoother and more even-keeled. And so I think that's where we have to go. I hope we don't miss this opportunity to make fundamental changes in our financial markets. So I'll stop with that and see if anyone... I'm supposed to instruct you that you're to take... Oh, we have people with other microphones around. Oh, okay. All right, there's a question right there. You can...
what were the triggering events that caused the downslide?
Okay, you know, I have a paper on that. That's a very, very interesting question. What ends bubbles? And the first thing to say is that it's always been hard to answer that. In the 1929 stock market boom, you notice how sudden and sharp the turnaround was? What was it? Well, people have gone back. It's been talked about for 70 years now. They go back and they look at newspapers on the morning of October 28, 1929. And what do you think they were talking about? There was no news, virtually no news on that day. It was a typical day. There was news, but it was about the stock market crash itself, or the drops they'd seen in the previous week. So the bubbles seem to have a strange tendency to end with no apparent reason. The end of the 1990s stock market boom, what happened? Well, people will say, well, the most prominent thing that happened was the dot-com bust. But then you say, well, what was the dot-com bust anyway? But that was another bursting of a bubble. It wasn't an exogenous event Now look at the bursting of the stock market boom in 2000. There's a curious fact about that, was that the Dow peaked in January of 2000. That is days after the end of the millennium, and so I have this sneaking suspicion that it was a hangover from the big party we had for the millennium. Someone told me, don't put that in your book. That is too wild. And so I'm left with no better explanation. But actually, the best thing might be that it's like anything else. The price can only go up so much. It has to come to an end. And that people were, many of them were expecting an end. There's no question about that. Many people were expecting an end, and they were wondering if this is it. And so I think that you do see that when you see a sharp drop, then a lot of people suddenly think this is it. I'm being very imprecise here. I wish I had a better answer to your question, but I think maybe that has to stand as the answer. So, okay, can you...
Thank you. Concerning the beginning of the housing bubble, and you were reaching for something to help explain its hyperbolic rise, about 1997, Mike Milken gave a presentation at the University of Pennsylvania, and he predicted that the securitization of mortgage derivatives would have an effect like that at Penn. You're right on target with it's a new day for regulation. There are two bills in the Congress, one in the Senate, Senate Bill 1782, introduced by Russ Feingold, Senator Byrd, Senator Kennedy, Durbin, Curry, Leahy, they've all co-sponsored it. What this bill will do is give investors today what they restore their constitutional right to take a broker or a bad advisor to court. They can't do that right now. There's a companion bill in the House sponsored by 102 members of Congress, the entire Pennsylvania delegation, and John Conyers' committee, Barney Franks, have signed off. That's House Bill 1030, the Arbitration Fairness Act of 207. This bill should get passed next year. Everybody ought to write their congressman.
What's the second bill do?
Well, what it does, it gives you your right again that you had 25 years ago to take a broker, to take a bank, take a financial intermediary to court, which you can't do now. Interestingly, the subprime mess is about $330 billion. Attorney General Cuomo, Attorney General Brown, Secretary Galvin of Massachusetts, they have tried to get restored about $160 billion to the financial institutions that were swindled. However, there's about $160 billion out there that many of the people in here are going to have to eat, and they can't take those brokers to court the way Cuomo can, the way Galvin can. This bill gets passed. it'll go a long way to solve a lot of those problems, because even if your master plan for the long term comes up, if no one's enforcing it, or you don't have due process to get them to enforce it, it won't have the effect that you would like it to have. I think this is a great opportunity to get that done.
Well, okay, I don't know the details of these bills. We have to...
I have copies of them right here, by the way.
Okay. Okay. There has to be a balance. Brokers have to be responsible for ethical behavior. And our government has relied largely on self-regulatory organizations like FINRA, which actually does, I think, an impressive job of educating brokers and enforcing ethical standards, but they're not perfect either. And so it is also part of our culture, our American tradition, that people can sue someone who treated them badly. So I can't comment on the details of the bill. We have to find the right balance. We have to have... I'd like to see more financial advice. I don't want to scare people out of the industry. It has to be done in such a way that a person can confidently pursue a career. But you're right. I think that we have not enough disinterested advice. And so that's what we have to try to pursue. It could be done by a carrot or a stick. I'm thinking of a carrot. You're thinking of a stick. Okay. All right. Maybe, was there someone on that side?
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Any relation between the Bush administration's policy of ownership society and the housing crisis?
Right. The term ownership society was used by President Bush in his 2004 election campaign. And I think it was a success. I think that was part of his success in that campaign, that it resonated with people. What he said is that we have to encourage people to take ownership of their own, accept their own responsibilities, but also that means telling people that you own something and you're responsible for it. And that sounds right to a lot of people. It's moving away from a state where the government runs everything and tells everyone what to do. But it also meant for George Bush that we want to encourage home ownership. And I think he is right that home ownership does encourage better citizenship and a better sense of belonging. One achievement that President Bush points to is that we've seen an increase in minority home ownership. And traditionally, minority groups have been less likely to own homes, and that might be a source of resentment and lack of feeling of unity with this country. Unfortunately, the system didn't work so well because a lot of these new homeowners are now being thrown out of their homes. And I don't think I don't think that's what George Bush wanted. And there was some inattention to the bad outcomes that can happen. So realistically, I don't think that everyone should be a homeowner. They have to be in the right circumstance to do it. And renting is another option as well. So we have to, again, strike the right balance. But what actually happened was the ownership society became a justification for continuing the boom and the bubble. And it became politically difficult to lean against. So we were promoting everyone gets a home. And unfortunately, we were doing it under conditions that were not viable in the long term. Okay, I don't know.
Professor Schiller, it's terrific to have you here. You've been one of the most thoughtful people with insight into the whole housing crisis. You said you don't like to do projections, but you, in fact, were one of the best thinkers about what was really happening here. How long until we get back to a balance if that chart seems like we're still so far out of balance?
Well, we're halfway back down, right? You can see it's exactly halfway. But that doesn't mean we will get all the way back down. Unfortunately, I produce these indexes, and so I'm not allowed to explicitly forecast them. So what can I say? Well, one thing that we did notice in our latest numbers, you can't really tell it in that chart, or maybe you can just ever so slightly, the rate of decline has started to decrease. But if I looked at these in the past, there's momentum. And if they're declining, they might just keep declining. The question is, when should you get into the market? I won't answer that. Okay. So, or do you want to try on this side? I'm trying to be fair to everyone. Maybe I should, but why does it matter? Or I could try to get someone in back next.
What are the implications to those of us who are not part of this bubble besides the potential recession?
They're not part of the real estate bubble. And besides the recession, that is the big thing. I suppose it could also be tax increases. That it's been complained, people have complained, that I prudently didn't buy into this bubble, and now the government is proposing bailing out people who did, the irresponsible ones who did, and using my money to bail them out. That is a concern. I don't think that's the way we want to do things. And so that's why I wanted to propose what I call the continuous workout mortgages, which would make it unnecessary for the government to do that the next time around. The mortgage would be priced in the market. It's not a government thing at all. A government, see, what I meant that the government has to do is analogous to what it did in 1933 after the housing, in the last big housing crisis. They created the home ownership, the homeowners loan corporation, which lent money to rescue borrowers, but they changed the terms. Before 1933, there were virtually no long-term mortgages. They were all short-term mortgages that had to be rolled over. They changed it from 5 years or less to 15 years or more. And so the government, while it was taking over the market, imposed a more enlightened standard on mortgages. So that's what I would like to see happen. It may not help you if you may end up footing some taxes to bail someone out. In the future, that won't happen again. The other side of it is that we live in an economic system that's so complex. Some people are aggrieved and have bad experiences and are treated badly, but it's hard to identify who they are and how to. There's no way to completely focus your help on the people who were badly treated. So we have to do some broad and general things. So it may be that it's not the best outcome for you as a non-homeowner if other homeowners are being bailed out. That's another reason to maybe limit the amount. But I think we do have to have some help for these people. So maybe someone in back, to be fair. How about way over there with a red tie?
One of your colleagues, Jeremy Siegel of Wharton, has written rather thoughtfully in his book, The Future of Investors, of bubble dynamics in emerging markets, China and India and the like. And I was wondering if you might comment on the nuances that you're aware of in terms of, for example, market corrections in areas where the economy is essentially extremely vibrant versus other areas where perhaps the economy is not so vibrant. One might argue that the correction in China could be contextualized in the context of their sort of speedy GDP growth and the fact that they might be the largest economy in the world and in the next 10, 20 years.
Right. Well, first of all, Jeremy Siegel is an old friend of mine from way back, even before I lived in Philadelphia. But we have kind of a difference of opinion. He's much more bullish than I am. So he writes a book called Stocks for the Long Run, and I write a book called Irrational Exuberance, but we remain friends. When it comes to India and China, I can easily see why there seem to be bubble-like phenomena there, because it is a time of rapid change. Bubbles tend to occur in places where there's a story and where there's a sense of action. And China and India both have a really strong sense of action right now. And I can't claim to have gone in. I showed you what stock prices have done. You know, there's a real estate boom as well. It has been in both China and India. And in India, notably, it's crashing now, although they don't have good statistics. The Reserve Bank of India has been working on developing a price index for Indian real estate, but they don't have it yet. Part of the reason is that in India, nobody reports the price accurately. There isn't the same standard. A lot of money is passed under the table. So you have to rely on impressions. But they have had a similar bubble. I suspect that real estate got overpriced in India and is correcting back down. But again, I can't claim to be an expert on Indian real estate. I can certainly understand why things should be volatile there. Incidentally, it also reflects world culture now. Next time you're on a transcontinental flight, you can pick out a Bollywood movie for a little to broaden your... That's Indian movie. And they look a lot like American movies to me now. And so it seems like there's a world culture. And the reason that so many of these things are happening all over the world is that we think more and more alike as time goes on. Okay, I have one more. I feel... Who has a really important question? All right. You are. This is a bad incentive, but anyway, you're standing up...
You were discussing the S&P 500, but what's your opinion, the return on the S&P, average annual return, including dividends, the S&P 500 for the next 10 years?
I guess I can predict the S&P 500 because I'm not on the index committee for that one. So according to Jeremy Siegel's book, it depends on the sample period. He goes back 200 years and argues that stock prices have gone up, I don't remember exactly, it's only 7% a year real for 200 years. And he had this plot. In many editions of his book, he had a plot showing how consistently it was a total value, reinvested value index going back. And it looks like a sure thing. This has been a sign of our times that... Everyone is saying this. You should be heavily into stocks. And so I don't have any evidence that his data are wrong. I don't know what to say about... But the thing that bothers me about this is that he doesn't present any argument why it should be that way. Why should the stock market dominate everything else? In fact, finance theory says the opposite, that there should be an equilibrium, that all investments should be risk-corrected. They should all be about the same. And then I also reflect about the stock market that there's so many factors that hit it, including political factors. You know, the government, in some countries, it's nationalized stock market. They take them completely away to zero. But they don't have to go all the way to nationalizing. All they do is raise the corporate profits tax. It's political. You know, McCain wants to cut the corporate profits tax, and that should have an immediate effect on the stock market. So we're voting on the stock market when we vote Obama versus McCain. And so who knows what the outcome... And you're talking about the long-run outcome. So I have to predict who's running for president in 10 or 20 years and how they're going to... Yeah. Yeah, well, I never claim that I know what the future is. But it seems to me, I would guess, if you want me to make a guess, I would say less than 7%, substantially less, because I'm thinking that high return for 200 years, that's what we call data mining. You know, people look through the data and they find all kinds of things. And you have to take account of the fact that if you search long and hard enough, you'll find something, and it may not be a fact of nature. It may be just a coincidence.
Thank you.
Thanks to Bob Shiller, and please join us upstairs for the book signing. Let's go right out there. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.